Hello, and welcome again to yet another episode of the Migration and Diaspora podcast, where we showcase projects and people from the field of migration and diaspora engagement. And I'm your host, Loxanne Harley from Homelands Advisory, your independent migration and diaspora agency. It's been a while since we talked about Latin America on this podcast, so I'm particularly excited today to present to you a conversation with Mara Tisara Luna, one of the region's preeminent experts on migration, and especially on children on the move in displacement situations, which is precisely the topic of the day. Before getting into that conversation, let me tell you a bit more about Mara. Mara is an international consultant focusing on displacement and protection responses in Latin America and the Caribbean. She's a fellow at the Collaborative on Global Children's Issues at Georgetown University and has provided technical assistance and applied research to UNICEF, the University of Edinburgh, Refugees International, and the International Refugee Assistance Project in 14 countries, contributing to more than 25 reports, handbooks, and short articles, which we'll link to in the show notes. In today's episode, we talk all about the rather harrowing protection issues faced by children in situations of displacement in Latin America. We start by outlining the state of play of forced displacement in the region, before focusing more specifically on the trends in displacement of children. Where and why are they displaced? What issues do they and their families face? And what is urgently needed to address these very pressing needs? Mara draws both from her recent research on very young children in Guatemala, as well as wider research on the topic. We've included links to some of these resources in the show notes, as there really is a lot to know, and we couldn't cover everything in this 45-minute podcast. And if you like this episode, you might be interested in episode 22, which is on Latin America's migration megatrends, and episode 5, which is on children on the move in West and Central Africa. I'll link to those in the show notes. Anyway, we've got a lot to unpack. So without further ado, I'd like to thank you again for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy the show. Good afternoon or good morning, Mara. Welcome to the Migration and Diaspora podcast. How are you doing, and where are you calling in from?
I'm good. Thank you very much. I'm calling in from California, so Silicon Valley, California.
Sunny Silicon Valley. And I understand you're not a native of the Silicon Valley. And so that begs the question, what is your own migration and diaspora story?
I am definitely not native from here. I am from Buenos Aires. So I am part of the Argentine diaspora, I suppose. And my grandparents came from Italy and from Spain. So I am also a little bit part of the Italian diaspora. Since I have the passport and I was able to live in Europe for many years, thanks to that, without worrying about migration procedures. And we finally moved here to California 2 years ago, and I am very, very happy. This is a very easy place to live, in part thanks to migrant-focused integration policies and cultural and national diversity.
Very interesting. So a very classic Argentinian combination of nationalities there, Italian and Spanish. And so you were tired of not having to navigate migration procedures in Europe. So you decided to migrate to a place where you did have to navigate some migration procedures. Very, very good to get to know you a bit more. Although obviously I've been very lucky to know you for a couple of years now. Let's talk about children on the move in Latin America. Let's start by setting the scene. You know, what are the main movements across the Americas? And I understand we're talking more about displacement. So what are the main displacement movements across the region?
Something that I need to say is that I prepared like a 15-page document for this podcast episode because I am a nerd. So if anyone wants to contact me after they listen to the episode and ask me for the references, you know, the statistics and these types of things, they can do it, of course. At the end of 2022, there were 21.5 million forcibly displaced and stateless people across the Americas. Now, the latest estimation for 2024 is 25 million. So what we see in the region is that displacement increases quite dramatically, let's say, from year to year. And there's a reported trend in some of the roads of younger children being on the move with their families. And what we know in general of all children is that 25% of all people on the move or all displaced people in the Americas are children. Also an increase from the previous years. This, of course, includes displaced people and refugees and people in refugee situations, stateless people, etc. The region also has a lot of legal migration that your previous invitees to this podcast or the previous guests that spoke out Latin America and the Caribbean spoke more than I. They spoke out migration governance. In my case, because I work only on protection, I deal with the most vulnerable of migrants, and all of the research that I do is about people on the move or displaced people who are in conditions of vulnerability.
Where are the main hotspots for displacement in the region?
There's structural migration that I won't speak about. My country, for example, of origin, Argentina, has received or has been a host of Paraguayan, Bolivian, and Peruvian migration since ever, basically since it is a nation. This is not what I will speak about. I will speak about the hotspots that are humanitarian hotspots. And basically, we can divide the situations between different sub-regions. So this is what I usually like doing. We have the Venezuelan situation that is usually the one that people are the most familiar with. So professionals working in migration. Since 2014, 7.7 million Venezuelans have fled the country. This is so this number or this figure is supposed to be higher than this, but the official number is 7.7 million. With a 77% increase since 2019. So the rate of displacement accelerated since approximately 2017. So what has happened in the past years is that Venezuelans who leave Venezuela are in increasingly worse conditions of vulnerability. So it is calculated that now 4.5 million Venezuelans abroad are in need of humanitarian assistance or assistance to be able to, you know, live and live well. And most of them, of course, are in Latin America. So an important thing that people not working in the region should know is that most Latin American migrants or Caribbean migrants or displaced peoples stay in the region. They don't migrate outside of the region, which would be usually the European Union. They stay in our region. And for people who don't know anything about Latin America, I can also tell you that 662 million people live in Latin America. So we are 8% of the worldwide population. And as I said before, we have like 25 million displaced people. So most of them live in another Latin American country. And that is important because that has led to other problems, which we are going to speak about later, and which is my topic of work. So how to protect all of these people who are displaced across the Americas. Another situation that I will cover a little bit in more in-depth later is the Colombian one, so affected both by internal displacement and displacement internationally, and also as a host country of Venezuelans and displaced peoples of other nationalities. Then when we go to Central America, we have, of course, the situation in the Northern Triangle of Central America, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. That is a decades-long situation of displacement. Nicaragua, that has had six different waves of mass emigration, so migration, outwards migration in the 18th and the 20th century. Most of them going to Costa Rica and Panama, but also to the US. And of course, Mexico. Mexico is everything. All of these countries exhibit very complex migration trends, of course, because they are countries of origin, destination, transit, return, everything. But Mexico in particular, because of its location next to the US and because of the fact that most people on the move across the Americas are trying to reach the US, this is what surveys told us. So 99% of people across the on the move across the Americas are trying to reach the US. Of course, we have stranded populations on the move in different parts of Mexico, living in dire conditions. We have returned Mexicans. We have 100,000 internally displaced people within Mexico. So it is a very complex situation. And a special note to the Caribbean, which doesn't get a lot of attention, especially Cubans and Haitians are the two nationalities that were the outward movements or outward displacement has increased dramatically in the past decade. Besides, of course, as I said before, structural, very long-term migration within the islands of the Caribbean. We have these two humanitarian situations that drive many Cubans and Haitians to leave their homes. And that's it. I could be speaking forever about this, but I won't.
Absolutely.
One hotspot, of course, that I need to special mention to this hotspot or two of these. One of them is the Darien Gap, which is a stretch of land where there's nothing. Latin America has what is called the Pan American Highway that goes from basically Alaska to Patagonia. It stops in the Darien Gap because it is a jungle that was thought not to be able to be penetrated. We understand that this is not true, of course, after so many hundreds of thousands of people have crossed it, and including children, and we will speak about this later.
Yeah, sure. So we've got Venezuela as a clear humanitarian crisis situation, hotspot for displacement. We've got Northern Triangle. We've got Mexico as, you know, as a really key transit zone as people try to move to the US, although, as you've said, the vast majority remain within the region. So that's the overall displacement picture. Now talking more specifically about children and children on the move or displaced children, do those movements broadly align with what you've just described, or are there other specific movements of children?
Yeah, so the main trends when it comes to children moving or not moving, as we will see, are mainly for the first one are those children who are displaced on the move across the Americas. So this group of people is called by UNHCR and IOM people in mixed movements, mixed and onward movements across the Americas. So that's the name because, as I said, they are moving towards the U.S. So the destination is very clear. So we have those children, as I said before, many of those are very young children. So one measurement that we can have of this is the number of people that have crossed the Darien Gap since there are many, many different routes, of course, but a large part of those who are trying to reach the US from South America need to compulsorily cross the Darien Gap. And we know that 50% of anyone crossing the Darien Gap in 2023 was below the age of 5. There were also 500 pregnant women. And so we know that there are many very young children moving with their parents. This is what I saw while doing field work. Of course, you see very young families with their very young children, so babies or toddlers, which has many consequences for them. Of the total number of children last year also crossing the Darien Gap was 120,000. So we can estimate that at any point in time, this is the number of children that are on the move across the Americas. Kind of. Of course, we have the DTM surveys and we have other types of surveys, but they don't survey each and every person on the move across the Americas, obviously, because that wouldn't be possible. These are figures that we can use to estimate the number of children. Then we have another situation that is that of children left behind. So children whose parents or whose main caregiver or were the main breadwinner migrates to send remittances and like that maintain their family. This topic was very much in fashion until 10 years ago, let's say. So the data that we have now, I mean, among researchers and international organizations, so the data that we have now is not that updated, but research back then used to say that 21% of children in Latin America live in that situation. So children who were left behind or who stayed behind. Then we have a third group of children that are those that have been trafficked across borders or within their same country, usually by criminal groups for sexual exploitation, mainly for girls, of course, and for labor exploitation in the countryside or in cities. And then we have another subcase of this case, which is not trafficking exactly, but it is children who move from the countryside to the city to provide labor in exchange of lodging and food. This is very common in some countries, historically common in some countries like Haiti. And then the child, unfortunately, in many cases becomes some form of maid of that family that hosted them. And then finally, we have a fourth group of children that are those affected by internal displacement. For those who don't work in the field of displacement, internal displacement is usually addressed by national public policy, besides, of course, by the work of international organizations and NGOs and humanitarian organizations. Usually the answers need to come from the state, so from the government, because these are populations from a country that are displaced within their same country of habitual residence or of origin. UNHCR has estimated that there are 9 million IDPs in the region, but because the data that we have from the countries is not updated many times, this is the case of Guatemala, for example. The figure from Guatemala is from the mid-90s, for example, of internally displaced people. Probably we are seeing more than 9 million internally displaced people in Latin America. And those are the main trends affecting children.
There's lots to talk about, I think, and especially you've very helpfully given us that bigger picture of the different type of children on the move in different contexts. And you know, I'd like to know a bit more about the specific research that you've been involved in and what you've learned, especially when it comes to the, well, both the root causes, but also the protection issues that the children face. And I think we can all imagine the types of risks that that children, especially the very young children that you've worked with, face. But it would be great just to hear your expert's perspective about some of the research that you've conducted.
There are many different trends that drive people to be displaced. It is very hard to generalize. You know, when you speak about, for example, regional migration and you work with policy frameworks, it is easier to generalize because Latin America has built its migration management framework and displacement management framework, the policy framework, legal framework, based on previous historical cooperation. So I think it is easier to generalize on some things. When it comes to the effects on children of migration, when it comes to the root causes of why children and families migrate, it is very hard to generalize.
That's a very good point. Okay. So I think that's a good segue to talk more specifically then about, you know, the research that you've conducted. I know you've worked for a lot of different clients in this field, but it'd be great to hear more about what you've learned about some of these protection issues.
The first thing is connected to the root causes for migration and for displacement, and why is it that there are 25 million people displaced in a region of 600 million? So what is going on? And there are certain trends that research has identified. They are mainly economic inequality and lack of opportunities, the security situation that is worsening, and climate change and man-made and natural disasters. Latin America and the Caribbean is famously unequal. I have some statistics, but the one that I like the most, that is very, I think it is like really pedagogic, is the study that the Inter-American Development Bank does, I think every year, where they show how many generations it takes for a low-income person to become middle class. In Colombia, it is 12, almost 12 generations, so 11 generations. In Brazil, it is 9. In Argentina, it is 6 generations. In Chile, 6 generations. And the average in the OECD is 5 generations. So that is something important. Many children migrate, especially adolescents and adults with their families, because not only they live in poverty, but they also know that there's no exit. So even if someone doesn't know these statistics, they can see that they won't have as many opportunities in their home as they would have if they migrated. So this would be reason number one. And this is connected, of course, to the labor migration that I mentioned before. So children being left behind and their caregivers sending remittances, and also children migrating with their working parents, their working caregivers, to work in rural sites, you know, in to do a rural or manual labor in other cities or in other countries temporarily. Another thing connected to economic inequality that drives migration is child poverty. So for many decades, this is not a new phenomenon. Poverty in Latin America has been concentrated in certain social groups. One of them is children. 45.5% of children live in poverty, which is higher than the average of all ages. So 13% average, 13% higher than the average, which helps explain why so many adolescents leave from certain countries. So the Northern Triangle, for example, is known for that adolescent children, so teenagers, being displaced or deciding to migrate to reunify with their families, but also to have opportunities to be able to do something, ser alguien en la vida, so do something of meaning with their lives. When it comes to my work in particular, I am focusing on Guatemala and on Guatemalan families, Guatemalan children. I decided to focus on this because in Latin America and in migration, evidence, or at least in the field of children's rights, evidence is very concentrated in certain countries. The same goes to interventions, funding, media attention, and anything that we can imagine. And those countries are Colombia and Mexico. So this is where we find the most war, you know, where the programs are concentrated, where the responses are concentrated, and where we see more going on. This can be very easily, you know, anyone can see the maps of services by R4B or any other of the multi-stakeholder consortiums that respond to the mass movement of Venezuelans, for example. And another trend that I saw that made me focus on Guatemala is that people on the move across the Americas in transit in Guatemala are in the agenda. Of course, there are centers to, you know, receive them at least temporarily. There are shelters, there are certain services, and there's more media attention, there's more attention by the international community. But Guatemalans who are returned to their communities of origin after trying to migrate to the US or after having lived in the US or Mexico for many years, or who migrate because they cannot live in their communities anymore, doesn't receive as much attention. And so I thought that it would be great to do research on these and see what is going on with children and families that are forced to migrate, and what are the responses that organizations are giving to these situations.
Sounds like really fascinating research, and we'll link to some of your research in the show notes as well. Just give us a flavor of some of the protection issues that you identified as part of this research in Guatemala.
We focused on the very youngest among children, that is early childhood. So children between 0 and 8 years old are considered as in the early childhood category. We are focusing on children between 0 and 6, so before they start school. And what we have seen is that, of course, they are affected by their parents' migration situation. I described the scenarios before. So those are the possible scenarios in which a young child can be involved. So when it comes to the children that we have been doing research on, so children 0 to 6 years old who are Guatemalan or who live permanently in Guatemala with their families, what we see is the same. So I prefer dividing children into category, which maybe is not nice, but the evidence that we have is usually from different categories of children researched separately. So this is the easiest way to present this. But of course, the same group of children can be affected by different effects of displacement at the same time or vice versa. So, as we know, early childhood would be babies and infants and toddlers, so very young children. are affected by whatever it affects their parents. You know, like in the past, there used to be a belief that because children are small in size and are not fully developed, we're not as affected by trauma or by stressful situations as adults. This is not true. There are many decades of research showing that what is called toxic stress, so being exposed to stress, to traumatic situations, to stressful situations for their parents, chronically, with no treatment, with no solutions, with no responses, can have long-lasting effects. So can have effects throughout their lives. And some of these immediate effects of migration that some children suffer is connected to their health. Of course, we know that the first years of our lives are crucial in cognitive development, physical development, and many times parents who are on the move cannot cater for their children's needs as much as if they were in their homes with resources to do so. So that is one of the things. There are responses for that. Luckily, in most Latin American countries, emergency health care is for free, and emergency nutrition the same, and the same emergency or non-emergency treatment for pregnant women are for free. So migrants or displaced people, even if they are in transit in a country, don't need to pay for them. Then also what we call risk to survival, especially for children who are exposed to climate change induced forced displacement. Because usually their families are fleeing their homes because they cannot maintain their livelihoods anymore in their homes, because their land is not productive anymore, or because they were hit by a man-made or a natural hazard, etc. Then in transit and in host communities, many children face barriers to access early education. Early education is usually not as developed as primary education in most countries. Sometimes the coverage is not enough. Sometimes what happens is that even if there's early childhood education places that are open to migrants, there aren't enough places, or families need to stay with the children while they are being educated, let's say, and that is not possible for a migrant family or displaced family, which that needs to sometimes do paperwork, so connected to their migrant status, of course, and work. So this is an issue that was identified. So the services exist, but they are not enough, let's say. And another situation with young migrant children, just like any other child, is that they need early child care, even if their parents are working all day, as I said before, and usually that's not available for rural workers. You know, there are so many stories, and I have also heard about them, of children who are on the work sites with their parents because their migrant parents, working parents, have nowhere to leave them while they work. And once they arrive at their destination, or while temporarily stranded in transit countries, it is very, very common for caregivers, for families, not to have access to dignified work that gives them healthcare, social services, social rights, or also that allows them a path to regularization, so that allows them to regularize their status. And this, of course, affects children. All families need money to buy stuff for their children here in the US, in Venezuela, in Colombia, everywhere else in the world. And so dignified work for their caregivers is one of the, it is not a priority that affects children directly, but it is one of the priorities that governments and organizations should try to address. And finally, I speak about this all the time, children belonging to historically marginalized groups are even more exposed to violence and to other human rights violations, because of how unfair our societies are structurally. So usually black people on the move, or black displaced people, indigenous displaced people, LGBTIQ plus caregivers, etc., and other groups are at the situation of heightened vulnerability than middle class parents on the move who have enough funds to reach the US-Mexico border, for example. And that's why I say that we usually focus on these groups, on the ones that are in conditions of heightened vulnerability.
Yeah, really interesting. And I'd like to learn a bit about what can be done to improve the situation. So you talked about a very large range of different issues, you know, from the kind of mental health to physical health challenges to the childcare, the lack of childcare options, and also the challenges that parents also face when they're on the move, which can then indirectly impact their children. So what can be done to improve the situation? Is it about, you know, ensuring that host countries are integrating migrant communities more into their social safety nets where they do exist? Is it about very targeted interventions to, for instance, address the specific mental health needs of children? What sorts of interventions could be developed to improve the situation?
So what we advocate for, usually, so people who see migration from the human rights perspective, is for governments, international cooperation agencies, and anyone who has any responsibility in providing rights to develop child-sensitive, protection-focused, human rights-based regional migration policies and national migration policies. These would be the opposite of security-oriented and security-focused migration policies. We know that deterrence policies in our region have only led to extremely unnecessary suffering, unnecessary human rights violations. A part of that is the proliferation of unofficial migration routes, which is what we see. All of those news that we read, also the IOM report on death speaks about this. All of these unnecessary deaths are connected to the multiplication of unofficial roads. And so families, children, people in general are moving in dangerous conditions. So that would be number one for regional policies and national, specifically migration management policies, to be protection centered instead of ensuring security centered. The second thing that activists usually recommend is that because we already have so many cooperation mechanisms, cooperation platforms that work across the Americas or in certain sub-regions, so the Caribbean, Central America, and Mexico, the response for Venezuelans, etc. There are many platforms that are already existing. We recommend that any child-focused measures or child protection measures are incorporated into the already existing platform. So there's no need to create a new platform for child protection or for children's rights. The idea is that it is a cross-cutting issue for all of these international or multilateral cooperation mechanisms that already exist, and multi-stakeholder cooperation mechanisms that already exist in the region. When it comes to humanitarian aid, humanitarian assistance, I have the information here on Guatemala, but there's, as I said before, there are a coordination platform for every sub-region. The services are started to be delivered in a more and more coordinated way, so which is great. And this has the potential of reaching families as a whole. So not only children individually through, for example, safe spaces, but also, as I said before, addressing the issues that affect the family as a whole, health, livelihoods, wage also, so integrated services. And this is the second thing that I want to say. This is what we need, integrated services. So not seeing the child as an individual who lives in a vacuum on its own, but providing services, as you said, to the community, to the society where the family is trying to integrate, to the family or to the caregiver herself or himself, and to the child. So services need to be integrated and need to be interagency and cross-cutting. So ideally, all services will benefit children. And when it comes to the area of responses that I care the most about, which is small organizations, small national organizations, community-based organizations, and grassroots organizations, so like what we call organizaciones de base in Spanish, what we see is a need to localize funding. So to provide funding directly to them, who are closer to the needs of the populations that they serve, be them populations trying to integrate or in transit, or the communities that are integrating those displaced populations. So more flexible funding, because they know what they need and they know what they need to do. So we need to support them, and more attention in general. I always say this, I love the Norwegian Refugee Council's neglected crisis report. We need to have a million neglected crisis reports and neglected organization reports also, if possible, because many times in most contexts in Latin America, the grassroots organizations, community-based organizations, are the one responding to the needs of people, displaced people first. They are the closest to them. They are working usually understaffed, underfunded, etc., overwhelmed staff of, you know, community-based organizations. We know this. And they don't receive as much attention. They are not as legitimized, unfortunately, because we have a wave of autocratic governments in our region. Many times they are not only not recognized, but they are being opposed by the governments of the countries where they operate. So I would say that support for community-based organizations.
Right. Well, I think plenty to chew over and mull over in terms of solutions. But Mara, thank you so much. I've learned a lot, and I hope our listeners have as well. And it's a really deep topic. And as you said at the beginning, it's difficult to talk through all the statistics on a podcast. So I think more than ever, I recommend that listeners check out the show notes, because we're going to link to a lot of research by Mara, as well as other experts on this topic. Before we go, Mara, how can listeners connect with you and learn more about your work?
Yeah, so I am very active on LinkedIn. You can write to me there, or you can visit my website, which will be linked. And there's a form where you can send me a message. So those are the two main ways of connecting with me.
Yeah, and I definitely recommend signing up to Mara's newsletter. And you may even come across some of some free resources that she's created, including what is excellently titled A Ridiculously Simple Guide.
Yeah.
Ridiculously Simplified Guide to Intersectional
Research and Advocacy.
Research. Thank you once again, Mara, for your time. And I look forward to staying in touch and revisiting this critical issue. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Migration and Diaspora Podcast, powered by Homelands Advisory, your independent migration and diaspora agency. If you've enjoyed the show and would like to support our channel, please feel free to share it or leave a review via your preferred podcasting platform. You can access the channel's full archive and show notes by visiting homelandsadvisory.com/podcast, where you can also get in touch if you'd like to be on the show. Thank you again, and see you next time.